Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen, so you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcast. That's gotomeeting.com/podcast for a free trial. It's time for the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz, your host. We're going to bring in Kevin Hoffman, who many of you enjoy a lot, we know, because we get a lot of email from you. He's my partner in crime, my sidekick, the guy that I do all of my research with and provides me and our firm with such an amazing amount of detail. We're going to talk about a lot of things today. The ping pong market. We're going to talk about the bond market, the economy. And as I promised you last week, we're also going to talk about hedging. But one of the things we have to really realize is how are we going to be preparing ourselves either for a pop or a drop on the three E's that are coming up. That's right. We have earnings, elections, and economics. And each of these will put a new spin on probably each daily move of the markets. As you've noticed, we've seen quite the spin lately. And we'll talk a little bit about some of the double dip in housing that we've seen, and we'll go over that. First, before we bring Kevin in, I wanted to kind of talk about some of the economics that we saw over the last couple of weeks. And this not only deals with here in the United States, but around the world. Because if you look at what happened this week, while we saw a very drastic drive towards the downside of markets because we saw a continuation of very sluggish economic numbers, almost every time we're seeing manufacturing miss, we're seeing retail questions, earnings were a big problem, and then all of a sudden China came in with a number that beat expectations but was still lower on their manufacturing number. But let me give you a kind of a recap of what happened over the last week and tell you what I think in summation this means, because right now, in the lull of the time where we don't have a lot of earnings coming out, the economics are going to trump anything else in the markets, and markets are reacting very, very strongly to each and every report that comes out. So I guess we can look at, for example, and start back with the numbers that we saw on the Case-Shiller Home Pricing Index. That was last Tuesday. And those came in a little bit better. But remember, we're really kind of in a slough coming up from a very, very low number. There were some outliers like we saw in California. The prices were a bit higher. But some of the Midwest, the prices still are very, very depressed. And when you look at the chart of the Case-Shiller, the housing numbers that we saw from existing sales and from the existing and new sales numbers, a lot of people, and us included, are really looking at this as the double dip in housing. When we look at things, though, on the other hand, like the Purchasing Manager Index, well, that came in again under the number that was anticipated and significantly under. Prior, it was about a 62.5, came in at 56.7. Expectations were for about 57. Now, there's a reason why I'm going through all these numbers in detail, and I'll sum it up for you in a second, so stay with me. The consumer confidence came out better than expected. It was actually 53, and there was only a 50.7 expectation, and it was also higher than last time. We also saw the National Association of Purchasing Managers Milwaukee number came out, actually soft and much lower than it was prior. And then we saw the mortgage applications up ever so slightly, But that really didn't mean much, did it? Because if you look at the mortgage applications over the last several months, they're pretty slow. The job cuts from Challenger came out and actually was a little bit better. We're seeing a lot less massive cutting when it comes to the jobs area. But the ADP number, which came out on Wednesday, was a big surprise because they were looking for somewhere in the neighborhood of about a 42,000 build on private employment. And they actually came in, let's see here. They're looking for a 15,000 build. Sorry, 15,000 build. They came in negative 10,000. Prior was a 42,000. Now, the ADP number usually correlates pretty well to the non-farm payrolls that come out on Friday. So a lot of people were looking at that and wondering what was going to be different and were we going to see a real lack of private payrolls being added this period. But then we fast forward and miraculously, we see the ISM manufacturing come out after almost every single other purchasing manager and manufacturing number around the country has come out very soft. And somehow, miracle of miracles, the ISM manufacturing number comes out at 56.3, up from the prior 55.5, and way above the estimates of about 52.8. That really took off and made the shorts get squeezed, shorts covered, on top of the Chinese numbers that we saw last week. And then on top of that, one more thing, there was some good news, slightly good news, on top of some negative news. Let's start with the negative news and build positively. Domestic vehicle sales are still sliding precipitously, as a matter of fact. They're on track to do about 8.6 million, which is far below the standard of all time before. As a matter of fact, if you look at the total versus domestic vehicle sales, you'll still see that both of those are sliding, and that means that even the international side of things is not holding it up very well. But then on Friday, we saw the unemployment claims come out, the NFP, the official. So we saw a 9.6 print on the official unemployment number. The U6 that we look at, which is the underemployed, actually ticked up dramatically. And we did see that another interesting part of this was that the private sector jumped up dramatically. Now, that's important because it was in direct conflict to the ABC, the ADP numbers that came out earlier in the week. So you have to scratch your head and wonder what's going on. And then finally, even after that pop and people were all excited about the unemployment rate, the ISM non-manufacturing composite, or the old service index that came out, was sharply lower. Prior, it was 54.5. The expectations were about 53.2. It came in at 51.5. That also ties out to what we saw in the UK overnight and from China. The UK service PMI survey declined to 51.3 in August from about 53.1 in July, and below the market expectations that were seen. We also saw that some good things in the emerging markets, Indian GDP rose 8.8%, but Japan is still having a lot of trouble. The Japanese PMI dropped down 2.7 points to 50. It's a 14-month low there. Industrial production, though, unexpectedly rose, gaining about almost 0.5% in the month. But the retail sales rose only slightly. What's going to happen here is what we fear is an inventory overload, a tremendous amount of inventory building that went on during this restocking cycle, and many of the manufacturers don't want to stop producing. They're not going to stop producing until they see a significant either return or stoppage of orders that flow through. So in other words, they're going to continue to do their best to increase their overall output in the face of what could be severe inventory builds. And we saw the retail numbers come out last week, some mixed, but yet at the same time, the department stores did much better. Some of the small, the teen retailers were kind of mixed. Abercrombie, again, did very poorly. Aeropostale did well. Zumies did very well. And we saw the big box retailers like a Macy's. We saw Nordstrom's just blow it out. That was awesome. And at the same time, there's a bifurcation when it comes to, you know, who is actually going to prosper during this economic, in this economic environment. I don't think that's changed a lot right now. So you have to keep on the lookout of how the cycle is turning, where people are going, and what the consumer is doing. So economics being the front and center of all this. The second thing is that we have to look out for a variety of things over next week. We have a lot of economics coming out next week. For example, we have in the beginning of the week, the after the Labor Day holiday, of course, we have coming out the mortgage applications again, the Beige Book, consumer credit, initial jobless claims, wholesale inventory. This is going to be next week. It's not going to be a very busy week next week, but yet at the same time, there is going to be some important numbers that come out. So we have to watch that. Earnings, very light right now. Not much to be too upset about unless we see that analysts are starting to bring down estimates. Is that going to happen? Probably. Are companies going to pre-announce like Intel did just recently? There's a chance of that. But what we've seen is a clear slowdown and a clear economic slowdown in much of Europe, which we think is going to have a real problem into the fourth quarter, into the beginning of 2011. And at the same time, we're seeing that Japan, with their yen so high at this point and with their economy on the rocks, is in peril of dropping down into the next recessionary period. And on top of that, we are still in a fragile state with unemployment so high. There are some good spots and some bright spots, clearly, that we've seen, but we still have to wonder about one thing. Is technology and retail and financials leading us down to the next leg lower in this market? And we're going to see pops up and down between those. So what we thought we would do is talk about some hedging things. One more thing you have to worry about. There's going to be a lot of rhetoric that's going to be screaming, talking, and there's going to be a lot of discussion that's been happening over the next, 3 weeks that we're going to see that are going to be leading up into the election. Everybody's going to be claiming victory. Everybody's going to be pointing fingers. One of the things that most people believe right now, most of the colleagues that I've talked to, is gridlock will be good. The fact that it doesn't sound like it's a good thing is quite different of what markets are what reflects in the markets after gridlock. Because right now there's a concern about excess stimulus being spent, reckless spending in stimulus packages, a lousy environment when it comes to the administration and Congress not seeing eye to eye, having a lot of roadblocks put in the way. And at this point right now, what we're seeing is that they keep on getting bowled down because we have a Democratic majority. So if we see a kind of a locked and a paralyzed Congress, again, that sounds bad, that may be actually good because there'll be a lot more bipartisanship that will be required in order to get things through. And the big question we have then, to finalize this point, is taxes. What's going to happen with the tax relief when it comes to, are we going to see a better level of employment and employee tax relief? Are we going to see an extension of the Bush tax credits? Or are we going to start paying back the deficit? Or just be as reckless as we've been before? That's going to be the big question that we have on the minds of a lot of investors right now. So with that in mind, again, with that kind of overriding situation being where we are from an economic standpoint, on a global and domestic standpoint, how are we going to actually invest moving forward? And more importantly, that's going to vary, of course, but more importantly, how can you actually hedge your portfolio if you prefer to and choose to in a time of economic uncertainty? So who better to discuss this than Kevin Hoffman? And I thought we'd go over, Kevin, kind of in a relaxed atmosphere, because a lot of this stuff can get kind of complicated, right?
That's right. There's a lot of jargon.
Yeah, so let's talk about some of the jargon. Let's talk about some of the basics, and then we'll get a little bit more, complicated. So let's discuss what is hedging anyway?
Well, I think with hedging, there's three basic strategies that you can use. You can use options, you can use leveraged ETFs, or even unleveraged ETFs, as well as futures, which becomes the most complicated form of hedging. But when we talk about hedging in general, hedging is just trying to protect your portfolio from any downside. It's like buying insurance on your portfolio, or putting in some kind of a position to protect your downside risk.
Right. So, I mean, it's not always possible to protect all the downside risk. And sometimes people don't want to go short. They can't go short because they have IRAs. So, I mean, where's the benefit of that? I mean, the average investor a lot of times wants to kind of like go for broke. So hedging's not for them, right? I mean, that's not...
Well, if you're looking to go for broke, then hedging may be right for you.
Explain that.
Well, if you're looking to go for broke and you want to protect your portfolio, and if you think there's actually some downside coming into the market, then it may be a good time to hedge out your portfolio. But, you know, then again, you're not going to catch all the upside if the market continues higher.
Right, so you eliminate some of the risk. What I'm saying is those, you know, there's two sides, right? You can go short 100%. I'm giving you the outsides here. You can go short 100% or you can go long 100%, let's say. That's the range, okay?
Right.
And hedging somehow, if you are long 100% and short 50% because you wanted to hedge it out. But then a lot of people say, hey, you know, I've gotten these emails in that says, well, what's the point of that? Let me just sell half my portfolio. And from there, what I'll do is I'll just simply leave it in cash. I mean, why would somebody hedge something instead of just doing that?
Well, I guess the difference there is that if you have individual positions that you particularly like, but you want to hedge out overall market risk, then that would be the case for getting 50% short in a broad-based market ETF, but still holding on to those positions that you generally like. You know, because in the marketplace, you know, there's always going to be something that's going to outperform better than the market. So if you think your particular positions that you're holding are going to outperform compared to the market, and you're going to hedge out the risk in the market, then, you know, it might be advantageous for you to do so.
Yeah, we talked about this with Terry Bedford a little bit last week, that he likes certain positions, and what he's going to do is at a certain level in the S&P, he's going to actually take out the risk of the market. And one of the things that's called, I think the best way to describe this is systematic risk, right? We want to take out the overall risk of the market, but yet at the same time, so in other words, if the market is the S&P 500, what you do is you can actually say, okay, I like the stocks that I have. I realize that a lot of stocks are, you know, moving together these days, more than ever before, as a matter of fact, we're seeing this movement. And that's the reason for that is because of the ETFs out there and because of futures trading. And that's what we've seen in the latter part of the summer is mostly ETF and futures trading. And that's been pushing things in one direction or the other very, very quickly. So now, let's assume for a minute we have life back to normal where markets didn't always work all together. So what you're saying is that we take out the systematic risk, the market risk from the market, by saying, okay, if I have a 100% invested in all these stocks that I like, and if I say, okay, I'm going to hedge out the risk, the hope is that I could still make money without a lot of downside because my stocks should be able to outperform because they're the best of the best stocks that are out there.
That's right.
All right, so that's interesting. So there's different ways to hedge, though. So, and there's different categories, right? There's the idea that you can hedge. For example, let's talk about something we recently did. I think this would be kind of cool. So we have bond portfolios for clients that are mixed with their equity portfolios.
Right.
All right. And we saw that the bond market had been rallying dramatically over the last 4 or 5 weeks. I mean, it's been rallying for a while, but I mean, just got out of control, right? Over the last, what was it, about 4 or 5 weeks or so?
Yeah. Yields have come down quite dramatically, which has resulted in higher bond prices.
Right.
So, you know, if anybody's got any of these, you know, bond mutual funds or any kind of a bond portfolio, you've seen dramatic changes in your fixed income portfolio,
right,
that you would normally, I guess, in a, you know, a normal, I don't know how you want to call it, a normal environment, you wouldn't see, you know, 10 to 15% gains,
right,
in a fixed income mutual fund, let's say.
Right. So what we did was we looked at what were the alternatives and what are you trying to hedge? You're trying to hedge the risk that interest rates will rise quickly and that what would happen is that the value of the bonds would come down dramatically. Something that we look at is something called convexity. This is the amount of movement that you'll see if a short-term pop in interest rates either going higher or lower will actually affect, and how much it would affect. It's a calculation. How much would it affect the bond? And you've seen this. You've seen, you know, when have you seen a bond fund be up 2% in a day? I mean, it's crazy. I mean, we've seen it a lot lately, right?
That's right, yeah.
I mean, so we're looking at this going, what's going on? I mean, why is this happening? Well, clearly it was a flight to safety.
Yep.
That was one of the things. It was also a chasing of yield because yields are so low right now.
Right.
And what do you build? Well, then you got everybody talking about bond bubbles and all that stuff, but forget the bond bubble, forget all that. What do you do? So there's only couple of ways that you could do this. You could actually sell your bonds, but then what are you going to do? How are you going to reinvest? That makes no sense.
Well, then also the other problem with selling bonds is if you have individual bonds, you're not going to get the best price. You know, a lot of times when you're trying to sell your bonds to a brokerage desk, they're taking their commission for one.
Scalping you.
That's right. They're taking a few points here and there on a bond portfolio that you probably, you don't see, you don't know it's there. It just doesn't seem as regulated as the equity industry, where it's very liquid in the equity environment, whereas fixed income is very illiquid.
Well, the other problem is that let's tell, I don't know if we've ever talked about this, but there is much more money to embed in a sale or a transaction of a bond than there is in equity, because you know that if you buy an equity and you buy it straight from one of these brokerage houses, you're going to get, let's say, a $6 commission or whatever they charge, okay? But the thing is, when you buy a bond, and you could look at anybody out there, you could look at your trade tickets, you're very rarely going to see if there's an extra transaction fee, because what they do is they embed it in the price of the bond. So let's say that somebody says, okay, hey, John, you want to buy this bond? It's a 5% bond over 10 years, tax-free, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, oh, 5%, that's great. I like that rate. But you know what? This bond really may have been, without the excess cost in it, a 5.25 bond. But that quarter is taken, spread out over time, and that's what the commission goes to the broker. So bonds can be packed much more dramatically with transaction fees, commissions, than you can see with stocks. And I agree with you. The regulatory authorities, I don't know why they don't require the commission spread to – and that, by the way, that commission spread is just between you and the broker you bought it from. What about the time that he bought it and then that was bought from somebody else? I mean,
right.
It's kind of like this gigantic amount of additional cost upon layer upon layer upon layer of middlemen that are involved in this. So, all right, so we have bond portfolios. Again, that's very difficult to get out of some because of the spreads that you may get and the hatchet job scalping that you'll get from the broker.
That's right, and the bid-ask spread is, something like $3,
right.
Whereas normally in an equity, it's, a penny at the very most.
Right. All right, so what do we do? Tell them what did we decide to do in that circumstance?
So in that case, what you can do is you can use a leveraged ETF or even an unleveraged ETF. We used TBT, which is the ProShares Ultra Short Layman. I guess it's Lehman. Barclays.
Yeah, it used to be Lehman. Now it's Barclays.
Right, the Barclays, and it's a longer term, the 20-plus year bonds. And basically what it does is it takes a short position on these 20-plus year bonds. And it's an easy, efficient way of, hedging out some of the risk if you think it's coming.
Right, and what was really interesting was, and these doubles you have to be really careful of, if you see a directional move and it continues, those are good. You got to be careful, depending on the chop, how you're actually investing these and what time period. We don't usually hold them for more than, let's say, any of these, probably, a month, maybe 3 weeks?
Yeah, I would be careful with anything over a month.
Yeah.
Even over 2 weeks would be...
Could get a little crazy sometimes, yeah. Depending on the chop.
That's right. Well, because, with these ETFs, if you mathematically break it down, you're actually playing against the house.
Right, right.
So, unless you're short the long. Which is something that you could do.
Short the long and short the short.
That's right.
Say that? Yeah, short the long and short them, and that's the point. But again, holding them for a period of time in a directional move can be very beneficial.
That's right, yeah, because of the compounding of it.
Right.
If the market continues to move one particular direction, the compound effect is tremendous.
Right. So this the interesting thing that we had happen was that when we saw markets move up recently due to the ISM number, et cetera, this week, what you saw was that bonds sold off. Not only did they sell off, they sold off dramatically. And TBT was like up 6% in one day, meaning that we saw a 3% move of the long bond on
right.
the downside.
Right.
And, this has been a very bad investment if you bought it and held it, because, let's be honest, the treasuries have been coming down and down and down in terms of yield, but their prices have been going up for some time. Now that could be turning around, even though Bernanke has stated that one of the things that they're going to do is to keep their balance sheets at the level that they are and go in and buy the 7 to 10 plus year. We don't know exactly where they're going to come out of this and what they're going to be buying, but they are going to hold up the bond market at least slightly. They want to keep rates down because they want mortgages to be much more affordable, and they want people to go out and borrow money. We've always questioned the wisdom of this in terms of the ability for people to borrow more money and just to create more debt. But there is wisdom in the ability for companies and individuals to refinance in the deleveraging process in order to give themselves a better deal, where you have companies like an IBM, J&J, and a few others, many others, that are refinancing at 1.5%. They're taking a huge amount of money off of the table and actually deleveraging themselves, not by changing the value of the debt outstanding, but the rate they're paying on it, maybe from, let's say, 3 to 1 to 1.5%. That's a substantial gain from a financial aspect for these companies. So what other ideas, you know, in terms of hedging?
Well, I guess one other comment to interject on that was with the Fed, and we actually saw Bernanke, I think it was through the minutes, I'm not sure, but I remember he said something to the order of they're purchasing more bonds in order to get people to invest in other things,
like
equities.
Right.
So that makes it much more advantageous for people to begin to invest in equities. And I think that's when we saw the market start to turn around a little bit. And with this recent non-farm payrolls number, we may see another some chirping from Honig to begin to raise rates again.
And he does that, doesn't he?
That's right.
You think that's what he was hired to do?
Just to be the dissenter?
Yeah, just because you need to have a dissenter there somewhere.
I mean, that's right.
You can't have everybody constantly being unanimous about it.
That's true.
But, at the same time, there's a lot of headwinds. We are cautiously optimistic. We went actually, we had a rough week this week because what happened was that we were short into the beginning, net short, neutral into the beginning of the week, added as the market started coming down, and they get, whipsawed on Wednesday and Thursday. And that was a problem. Our long positions performed beautifully, absolutely beautifully. A lot of them broke out to all-time highs, and we're seeing those do well, but you're being held back this week. You look at Monday and Tuesday as an example, and if you're hedging a portfolio, you have to look at, okay, Monday and Tuesday, markets were down like 1.6%, and if you were hedged properly, you didn't take that risk. You didn't get those losses. And all of a sudden, you turn around the next day, and you're still hedged, and maybe you're not going to get those gains either because of your hedging. So you have to decide what level of the hedge you're going to let go, or at least start to eliminate some of the hedge that you have. So when we talk about the ETFs, those are one way. And name some of the ones that we usually use in terms of some of the hedging.
Right. So some of the symbols are TWM, which is the ProShares Russell 2000 short. And then you have the SDS, which is the S&P short. And then also there's the QUID, which is the NASDAQ 100 short. But with some of those, you have to be careful. The NASDAQ 100, you'll notice that Apple is...
like 60% of it or something like that. It's a ridiculous number.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
So you can use those. And
But the point is, let's just back up. The reason you may not want to use that is because Apple holds such a primary position in the NASDAQ 100 that you're really more so betting on Apple than you are on anything else.
Right. You're really not taking out that systematic risk that you talked about earlier. You're more still looking at the company risk, and Apple would be the major company in that position.
Right. So if you have Apple and you buy that, you kind of neutralize yourself.
That's right.
Yeah, that's not a good thing. So there's TWM. Now, on the other side, there's a different kind of hedge. It's a bullish hedge. For example, let's say that you're short stocks and you think that you want to take out the systematic risk of the market. What would you do on the other side?
Well, you can get long if you want. You could do SSO, which is the long S&P leveraged. And then there's the QLD, which is the long NASDAQ 100. And then the UWM, which I believe is the long Russell 2000.
Right.
And these are all leveraged positions. So once again, you still have to be careful with that that leverage exposure. But the good thing about the leverage is the fact that it takes less cash out of your pocket in order to hedge any downside risk from a larger portfolio.
Right. So there's different ways to do this. So that's one way. Of course, going to cash is another way. It creates some problems with that. You can flip in and out, long, short, of course, and keep your core holding. So again, just to kind of describe this to you, it's something like this. We'll use one stock as an example. So let's say you bought a stock. Let's just use Apple as the example. So you buy Apple. You really like Apple. Apple's going to do great in your opinion, and all the research that you've done brings you to that. So you hold a position in Apple. Now you say, you know what? I have a thought. that markets are going to start coming down. And because they're so highly correlated right now, Apple also is going to come down. Some of the big portfolio managers are going to start selling it and raising cash, etc. So what you could do is one of the two things. Now, with one stock, it doesn't work out as well. But assuming you have a portfolio of stocks, you can then go and then purchase an ETF or a leveraged ETF that is short the markets that are most representative of your portfolio. So if you only have banking stocks in your portfolio, what you can do is you can say, okay, I have the best of the best banking stocks in my portfolio right now. And what I want to do is I want to go out and actually buy the inverse, let's say SKF, which is the inverse of the financial and banking area. That would allow you to hopefully eliminate the systematic risk of that particular sector and then hold the best of the best inside of the banking sector. So that's kind of how that works with ETFs and leveraged ETFs, inverse and positive. So there's also, I know, Kevin, you and I have talked about options, and we haven't used them lately with our clients for a lot of different reasons. But, you know, some of that being that the VIX was high and premiums were high, and we felt it wasn't as an appropriate place to be because of the time restraints on the option. But talk a little bit about options, some plays that people can use for hedging or at least bringing down risk or enhancing a portfolio.
Well, that's right. When you were talking about just one particular stock, if you only have one stock in your portfolio, options may be the better play, obviously. Options allow you the ability to basically buy insurance for your particular position that you have. Options can be bought on indices such as the SPY, which is the S&P 500 index, or you can buy it on an individual position. And options, although not quite as liquid as individual securities, they are quite liquid in the market, especially for some of the bigger equity positions.
Right.
So now with options, what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to pay a premium, or like the amount that you would pay to cover your house from any kind of a damage.
The insurance cost.
Right, it's the insurance cost. And when you put up this money, you basically have the ability to leverage it in order to use less money to control a greater number of shares. So let's say if you only have 100 shares of Apple, you would only have to buy one option, right?
Right.
And that option would cost you maybe, I don't know what the current premiums are on Apple.
Yeah, let's just say it's $8.
It's $8.
Because it could be for any price, any time frame.
Right. So if you have it an $8 a premium, then you'd have $800 cash out of your pocket, but you'd be able to cover your, I guess that would be a $25,000 position in Apple if you're trading at $250.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, you know, that might be a worthwhile premium if you believe the stock may take a downside hit.
But it's got to go beyond, let's say, in our example, the $8.
That's right.
Because you paid for that.
Yeah, it had to go down below $242 before you would actually see any improvement in your option price.
Right.
Although the option price may come up, because you have the time value of expiration, and then you also have the volatility component, which Andrew mentioned earlier. The volatility component, which you can watch the VIX, most of the time it's quoted on CNBC or any kind of other trading platform. But the VIX is what will determine a portion of the premium. So as the VIX increases in price, the premium on that particular option will also go up in price. It's what a lot of traders call vol, or volatility. And then you also have the time value component. So the longer period of time that the option has, the more expensive it becomes.
Mm-hmm. So again, that's a problem because if you know it depends on what camp you want to be in. You know, you can do things like covered calls, which can help you out to enhance your income potential on a stock by selling out a call sometime in the future and taking in the premium, and then hopefully your stock stays right where it is and doesn't move at all, and you never get it called away, and you do this over and over and over and over. The problem with the covered call, though, is in a volatile market, if your stock moves down dramatically, and here's the example, back to Apple, if you have Apple at $250, and that's where you bought it, and you sell a covered call, let's say at the price of $275, that you're willing to sell the stock to somebody else at $275, and you get in, let's say, I don't know, $5 for that right to do so for the next 2 months. If your stock drops precipitously, you're still holding on to the call. You got only your premium in, but did your premium actually make up for the fall of the stock? Now, I know most people believe that Apple will never fall, but the fact of the matter is that we've seen it drop already. We've seen it drop and, frankly, stay stagnant. It hasn't gone anywhere. So when you look at these kind of equations, and there's a lot of places that you could find the data and information to input a covered call worksheet. Look, just Google covered call worksheet or covered call analysis or something of that nature. Options Monster over at with my friend John Najarian and that group, they have plenty of little tools like that that you can take a look at. But options are another great way to hedge a individual position or a portfolio from actually the systematic risk. So you can get down to more of a basic one-on-one relationship with a stock when it comes to options, where you really can't do that with the ETFs because there's really no match that gives you a one-to-one relationship, right?
Right. That's right.
So in what circumstances do you want to hedge? What's kind of the thinking out there when that's a good idea? When would it be like, oh, no, we don't want to do this? What's your framework on that?
Well, that's a very, very tough question because, you know, a lot of times you have the market doing things that, you know, aren't normal or not what you would normally think. So sometimes you'll see, you know, economic data coming out that's, you know, not exactly as good as what economists think it is.
Right.
And you'll think, okay, I think maybe the market will go down from here. The only problem is you get one piece of information or something that trumps it, and then the market moves up. And now you're stuck in this position, and you have to decide, you know, do I need to get out? Do I need to stay in?
Do I need to add to it? I mean, yeah, right.
You know, it really becomes a timing question. And, you know, timing is very difficult on the market. And it's just a matter of trying to find a time for you to hedge that portfolio when you believe that there's more risk involved in the market than you're willing to take on, then hedging may be something worthwhile to do. Or there's also, you know, asset allocation. But generally, if you have a position full of equities, then hedging is, you know, the best way to reduce any kind of risk that you need to get out of the market.
Right, aside from just selling everything and being away from it and stepping aside.
Right.
But when it comes to the hedging, I totally agree with you that, especially these days, and that example you brought is probably that one that we've been butting our heads about this particular week, where we saw a lot of negative sentiment being brought in by a lot of negative economic reports that we talked about at the top of the show. And then we were getting short, and then whack, we just got whacked overnight. There was really nothing you could do with that transaction, and we had to decide what to do with it. We felt that at that time that, you know what, we were going to hold on to it till we get to a certain point. We're getting very close to that point from a trending standpoint, and then we'll have to release it and take the loss with that and say, you know what, we missed that gain on the market for those few days, and say, you know what, that before that we did very well with the hedge and it held on, and you know, come back to it if we see it starting to move lower. But, you know, you have to realize that there is a point you have to give it up. I've seen portfolios that have come through here that are hedged out. And I say, when did that hedge go on? And they say, you know, like a year ago. I'm like, well, what's the point of that? Why would you be hedging the whole time?
Right.
Make up your mind whether you want to be in or out. You know, what the percentage you want to be in or out. What are the places that you want to be? And then if the hedge just keeps on bleeding for a year, the hedge probably should have been removed somewhere along the line. Somewhere.
That's right. Hedges are supposed to be a short-term bet or a short-term play on the market. Unless, of course, you know, it's something that you're actually hedging out for a business. You know, people can hedge out, you know, currency risk, or they can hedge out, you know, inflation risks. But, you know, when you're hedging out an equity portfolio, it should really be something that you're looking at from a short-term opportunity rather than a, you know, 1-2 year play.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because that's something we should talk about as currency plays for a second. We've been talking about our play on the yen, but you know what? There's something interesting. You know, if you invest in I think I talked about this last week, but this is really interesting because when you invest in international investments, such as either companies individually, possibly, or an ETF or a mutual fund, you don't know in a mutual fund if they're hedging or not, and what's going to happen to the differential between the value of what you have and the value of the remainder after currency transactions and currency conversion takes place. So when you're talking about hedging, here's something interesting to think about. If you invest in a Japanese ETF, and oftentimes Japan's market is very susceptible to risk related to a strengthening yen. And if the yen strengthens and keeps on strengthening, it's really going to hurt their exports, and it just is a real problem. We're at a point right now that intervention needs to be done or their exports are really going to start suffering. So when you look at that, if there is intervention, the yen will come down, but yet at the same time, their markets will come up. So if you just buy, and vice versa, so if you just buy the ETF, which I believe is EWJ, and if you just buy that only and you are long that position, you may never actually get anywhere with the push me, pull me due to the currency conversion. So you may want to add a little bit of a position that actually will counteract some of that. So therefore, you can get the benefit of the yen and just hedge out the yen in terms of it to make it a pure play investment on the Japanese market rather than the Japanese market and the yen at the same time.
That's right. It's a double-edged sword on that one because you have to play both the currency and the market on the other side. Investors saw this problem, I guess that was almost 2-3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We saw the euro climb against the dollar to about $1.60, I think, was the high.
Right.
And you know, American investors saw great gains in both their emerging market portfolios and their European exposure due to this gigantic currency increase. But now, you know, when the dollar started to come down, foreign mutual funds and foreign ETFs really got hit hard, even though, you know, their markets weren't down quite as much as what the ETF was.
Right, exactly. All right, so, you know, I think that due to the fact that it's a Labor Day weekend and we wanted to just have a show really related to hedging primarily, we're going to – any more things you want to add to the discussion?
I mean, we could talk a little bit about futures, but then, you know, that's getting into the big boys kind of a –
Yeah, I mean, futures are an interesting play, and, you know, the problem is you leverage them up and you're going to have a lot of money on the table for a small amount of money out of pocket, which also means a lot of potential risk for the reward that you can get.
Right.
So
very high risk.
Very high risk, only because the movement is so dramatic.
That's right, and you can lose a lot more money than what you put in. If you put up $5,000 for a futures transaction, your risk is almost infinite.
That's not exactly what we would call a good strategy for, I think, our listeners.
Yeah, probably not a good individual investor.
Right. So let's skip that.
That's good.
Let's skip that.
maybe another time.
Yeah, maybe another time we'll talk about some futures and things like that. But, I mean, you know, I think the best way to go is the options and the other side. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to be necessarily totally bearish or totally bullish here, but it just means that this is a way to protect your portfolio in a way that just, you know, is help. We talk about this a lot in the Disciplined Investor book itself over at Amazon. You can pick that up. And I don't know, it's $15 or something like that over at Amazon. And it's also on audible.com. You can download it over at Amazon as well. It's available for the Kindle as well. So there's kind of a whole section on two things. One of them is GICs and annuities and safe and guaranteed investments. Another section on hedging and, I should say, risk management is probably the best way to describe it.
That's right.
So with that, I want to wish you a happy Labor Day. What are you doing for Labor Day? Anything exciting?
I don't have anything really going on. How about you?
You have nothing going on?
Mm-hmm.
I got some work.
Just
going
to relax, go to the beach, enjoy the sun, hopefully.
Looks like
it's raining right now.
Yeah, it's going to rain. We got that hurricane coming through. So I'm going to go up to the lake house and spend a little time up there with the family and probably be bright and cheery, ready to come back next week to see what is going on and if the rally can continue, which we have our doubts, but, you know, we'll see what happens with the economic news and with the sentiment, because we do believe that there'll be a lot more volume coming back, maybe not just initially, but as the week and month progresses, a lot more volume coming in when everybody returns from their little Hamptons and Miami vacation, which is going to be kind of exciting. So I wish you all a very wonderful, happy, healthy Labor Day. I hope you enjoy yourself. You get on the beach, you get some hot dogs and hamburgers, or for those of you that are health conscious out there, some
chicken breast, maybe?
Maybe some chicken breast, or maybe some
turkey
black
breast.
Bean hamburgers, you know, something like that. That
or
could
Boca
be
Boca burgers.
The Boca burgers. you know, something that you and your family and your loved ones can have a good time relaxing, because one of the things you want to remember is you can't spend all your time working. It's just the reason why I've always said that when you look at football teams, why do they take that time off? It's to rejuvenate, rethink, get themselves back in the game, because if you're there all the time, you can't see so clearly. With that in mind, I wish you a wonderful, wonderful weekend, a elongated weekend, and I'll see you next week. We have coming up Kate Stalter from Investors Business Daily, and the following week we have
Mike Bellafiore.
Mike Bellafiore, and he wrote a great book on trading. We'll have him come in, very highly recommended by our good friend Brian Shannon. So we got an action pack, and then Frank Curzio. And you know what's interesting about Frank? He just got back from a three-week whirlwind trip to China on business, checking out all sorts of companies, checking out all sorts of opportunities. I'm going to bring him back on, and we're going to have a nice little chat with my buddy boy, Frankie, and see what he has to say about what is the next big thing in China. I hope that you enjoyed. We'll speak to you soon. This is Andrew Horowitz, episode number 177 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. See you real soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.